Welcome, everybody. This is the first Mises Academy version or offering of a class called Anarcho-Capitalism. It's a modified version of a class that I gave 2 years ago that was talking about private law and defense, but this is an expanded version of that class that gives you an extra 2 weeks of discussion. You can see here we've got the outline for tonight's course, and you can download this if you want to have this PowerPoint locally. For today's lecture, that's not so crucial because this is mostly just going to be a placeholder for me to keep my place in the lecture and go through. So first, let me very quickly, I'll try to keep this pretty brief, go through just an outline of how this course is going to work, because we do have a lot of people who are new to Mises Academy with this class, so I just want to make sure we don't lose everybody up front. So the first thing is that there's the live lectures on Wednesday, like we're hearing right now. Should be a 15-minute Q&A at the end, but the people who have taken my classes know that often doesn't happen because I get so excited and I just can't shut up during the main prepared remarks. If you do have a Q&A question, though, it will eventually get answered somehow. Either I will field it live during the Wednesday lectures, or if I don't get to it, then what I'll do is copy it and save it, and then I'll answer it on the Moodle framework. Okay, so the place where you go to see the syllabus, and if you're taking quizzes, the place where you go to do that, there's a section there where under the news feed that I'll just have a thread like every week saying Q&A from week three or whatever. You can catch it there. All right. If you are going to post questions, though, not in the chat box, but in, appropriately enough, the Q&A. Okay, so if you're here listening to me talk live right now, you're able to type in stuff, and it's fine for you guys to have little conversations in the chat box and talk about, you know, what a hilarious joke I just dropped and that sort of thing. But if you have a question for me, don't put it there because it moves too fast. So put it in the specially marked container or window that's labeled Q&A. And then at the end of the lecture, I'll go there. So if I say something that you don't understand while I'm in the middle of these prepared remarks, just put it in there and eventually I'll see the question. Okay, remember, a grade is optional. So if you want to be graded in this course, just take the quizzes when they're offered and take the final exam. And I won't go into it now, but I'll email out instructions as to how you do that to make sure you don't get left behind. All that stuff, the quizzes, the final exam, you'll do through the Moodle framework. Okay, so the way you log in there, the way you go and see what the readings are for each week, in that environment, when they're posted, you'll be able to see a quiz for each week, and then at the end, you'll see the quiz for that last week six, and then you'll also see the final once it's posted. Okay, so that's where you do it there. One thing, there's going to be no extensions on the quiz availability. So I'll give you a two-week window in which to take a quiz and a two-week window in which to take the final. But then after that, that's it. Because with a class this big, I can't be making exceptions, and I don't want to get in the position of judging is your excuse valid or not. Okay, so just try to do all that stuff. And if you email me and tell me how you were abducted by aliens and that's why you didn't take the quiz on time, and so can we reopen it so you can take quiz three, even though it's closed to everybody else, the answer is going to be no, just because otherwise you're going to get in huge debates. All right, so just make sure you do that. If you do miss a quiz, it's not the end of the world. They're weighted very low. You can still probably get an A in the course if you even miss a quiz entirely. Anything else? Everything is recorded. So if you miss one of the lectures, they will all be recorded and posted on Moodle for you to download in various formats. But there is a little bit of a lag because it takes a while for one of the TAs to transfer it into the different types of formats you might want. But usually within 48 hours after I give a Wednesday lecture, you can go and log into Moodle and then download it in case you had to work or something. Okay, let's see, anything else? The Saturday office hours are optional. And what I mean by optional in this context is that I will never ask you a question on a quiz or the final where you would have needed to listen to the to what I said during a Saturday session in order for you to get it right. All right, so that's what I mean when I say it's optional. Of course, you're welcome to show up and encouraged to show up, but it is purely, it's only there to help you do better. It's not an extra responsibility you need to do if you're taking the course for credit. Let's see. If you're not taking the course for credit, you don't have to let us know. Just don't take the quizzes and we'll get the hint. All right, I think, let's see, last thing is, if you have any problems in terms of technical issues, like logging in, or you're trying to download the lecture from week two and you can't find it, that kind of stuff, the people to email are ta@mises.com. Okay, so that's a group email, and just put in the subject line, like, anarchy class, Murphy, and then, you know, login problem or whatever, and so that the people who are catering to this particular class will, or responsible for this class, will field that. If you have a question about the content, you know, you're asked, wouldn't the insurance companies all form a giant state and that kind of stuff, then email that to me and use this email will work, RPM, which stands for Robert Patrick Murphy, at consultingbyrpm.com. So it's consultingbyrpm.com. And that's my personal business email address. And send it there. But in the subject line, say anarchy class or something like that, so that I know, because you can imagine I'm an important guy. I get all kinds of unsolicited emails. So I need to be able to tell the difference between someone, a student who's in my class currently sending me a question versus, you know, Britney Spears wondering what I'm doing on Friday. All right. It's Mises.com, everybody. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump into the lecture now. Incidentally, what I'm doing in this first session, which is Private Law 1, right? What do I mean by this 1? Well, next week we're doing Private Law 2. So what I'm doing, the way I'm breaking it up, is today I'm going to try to give you sort of a sketch of the positive theory. I want to just explore the very possibility that there could be a private legal system, and because you can see there's some conceptual framing problems with this. And so we're just going to go over just to get to open your mind up and to see the types of reasoning to try to get you to see that it's not a crazy idea and that, you know, it could actually work, and then give you an analogy of things that it's similar to, or try to show you in other contexts the sort of objection that you naturally would have to a private legal system, you know, the sorts of criticisms that come to mind, or the fears you would have, and like you're thinking, what, that doesn't even make any sense, but those sorts of objections would seem silly in other contexts, right? So that's the kind of thing I'm going to try to show you today, and then just to give you a basic framework for how it could work. And then next week, in the lecture that's going to be called Private Law 2, I'm going to spend most of that time dealing with objections. Okay, so things like, wouldn't the mafia just take over, or wouldn't it just devolve into a bunch of roving warlords, or wouldn't the insurance companies that become strongest form a cartel and then institute a new state, or that kind of stuff. All right, so I'm not going to deal with those too much tonight. I'm going to defer that till next week. So today, let's just really work through the framework of thinking through the logic of this and how could you possibly even start? You know, what's step one of this? It doesn't, you know, how do you even get off the ground, let alone wondering, would it actually work in practice and would it be better than what we have right now? Let me also just sort of give a justification for this whole topic. It might be obvious to some of you, but a lot of people say, you Rothbardians or you anarcho-capitalists more generally are crazy. You're wasting everybody's time. Look, we have a serious issue of an overgrown government right now that's taken over healthcare, that's got drones all over the planet, and it's spending way too much money, deficits that are $1 trillion plus for years at a time. Do you really think you should be worrying right now about the theory of a completely anarchist free market society? You know, you should be writing letters to the editor of the Wall Street Journal talking about Obamacare instead of doing this kind of stuff and sitting around in a circle with a bunch of Rothbardians arguing about the finer points. Right, so you hear objections like that a lot, and so why do we think it's important to offer a class like this and explore this theory? Well, I think, you know, there's two things. One is just it's kind of cool that if you're going to delve into the free market economics and you start wondering, well, gee, could they privatize roads? Oh, how could that work? All right, could you get rid of postal delivery by a monopolized organization? Yeah, that might work. That sort of thing. Well, the logical extension of that, the logical conclusion, of course, is to not have the state provide judicial and military services. And so if you can think through the logic of that, that's just pushing it to its extreme. So if you're somebody who's into free market economics, that's the best place to go. You know, that's the most interesting topic because that seems like prima facie the hardest thing for a free market to provide. So going hand in hand with that, then, I think actually it's, for certain people at least, it's easier to win converts to libertarianism generically by going right for the throat, if you will. All right, so in other words, if you start off the discussion by saying, yes, yes, we need to have a government for the law and courts and maybe to deliver mail and to provide minimum regulations on airline safety and food purity and to make sure that financial firms don't just bilk their customers like crazy. But hey, I mean, we don't need to have a military draft. That would be inefficient. We should have taxation that raises money to pay troops a wage, because Milton Friedman showed us that that was a better way to raise an army. But we obviously need taxes to raise an army, because otherwise we just get invaded by Canada, right? So if you start up the discussion that way, it actually, I think, weakens the person who's hearing you, weakens the case for the free market. And the other thing, too, is it then completely takes any sort of principled moral argument off the table. You can't, it's hard to say, for example, that, oh my gosh, Obamacare needs to be rolled back because the government has no business telling me about my health care, because the government, by your own logic, if you believe in a minimal state, you think the government has business telling you what wars you have to fund, and it has business telling you what judge you have to go to if you have a dispute with your neighbor, and that sort of thing. All right, so once you open Pandora's box there, it's hard to have this real hardcore principled objection to some big government thing if you believe in small government. So whereas in contrast, a Rothbardian, and by the way, I mean, this class is not just about the thought of Murray Rothbard, but he's going to be the biggest influence in the sort of thing we talk about, and I'm just assuming most of you coming through Mises.org are fans of Murray Rothbard. So that's why I'm going to be talking about him more than any other single economist. But this is not a class about Rothbard per se, but I'll be using his name a lot. So the good thing is, the sort of bonus feature, if you do happen to think that the market could work in providing police services and judicial services and military defense from foreign invaders, if you think the market could work in those areas, then all of a sudden those moral arguments are back on the table. You can actually say, I don't think there should be taxation, period. Whereas if you think, oh, well, there needs to be a government for the police and the courts, you can't really say that. Then you're just quibbling over how much taxation is oppressive or not. So, I mean, who was it? I think it was George W. Bush. One of his campaign slogans one time was, because it's your money. And so he was trying to tell the voter, I don't remember if it was the first election or the re-election, but he was trying to tell the voters, vote for me instead of that Democrat because the Democrats want to raise your taxes and I'm here to tell you it's your money. But no, George Bush didn't actually believe that. He wasn't campaigning on eliminating all taxes. So what he was really saying is, we're only going to take 38% of your money, or 62% of it is yours, the rest is ours. But this clown over here, this nut job, thinks that he should be able to take 39% or even 40%. Can you imagine that? So once you start talking like that, that sounds silly. So that's what I mean. And a lot of things that conservative Republicans, if you're listening to Rush Limbaugh or somebody, even people that are apparently extremely hardcore in modern conventional political discourse, their own slogan, they actually don't believe them. They don't think that the individual is autonomous against the power of the state, because they think there's all sorts of circumstances in which the state can tell you, the individual, what you need to do for the collective good. And so you see that they actually don't take their own rhetoric seriously. Okay, so that's another reason I think it's important to go through this, because for the average American, I think most of them, and I know that we have more than just American viewers here, but I'll be speaking about the American context because that's the one I know most know the most. Very few people will say, oh, yeah, I think the government owns your house and then it allows you to live there as long as you pay your property taxes, because really the government's the owner. Most people don't think like that. Most people think that, no, you own your house, but you have to pay property taxes. Well, why? How come the government can kick me out of my own house if I don't pay property taxes? What if I don't like what they're spending the money on? And most people will be, well, yeah, that does kind of, but there's no choice, because we need to have police and we need to have firefighters and we need to have judges and we got to have nuclear missiles, because otherwise those crazy communist Chinese are going to take over. And so that's really what they ultimately fall back on. It's not that most Americans in day-to-day life can pull out some political treatise and give you a discourse upon the role of government and why it makes sense for them to tax you. Really, most people just think it's a pragmatic argument that we'd all be enslaved if we didn't have our own government to protect us. And so that's really, I think, if your goal is to ultimately advance liberty, I'm saying it actually in the long run might do more rhetorically by focusing on these very pure cases and to show the market can work even here, where most people right now think it couldn't possibly work. And then once you open that up, the logic of it just flows naturally. Okay. So let me spend a few minutes talking about the nature of law. And you might think that that's pretty obvious. Like, we all know what we mean by laws, but I think actually we don't. That a lot of times when you start arguing with people about these things, you see there's all these different concepts floating around. And so let's try to just, I'm not going to give you a definition per se, but I just want to just make some observations to sort of hone our thinking, so at least we'll get on the right track as to what would it even mean if we want to say, could market-based institutions provide the legal framework in a society? What do we mean by legal framework? Okay, so first of all, as I want to point out in this slide, It's distinct from morality. Okay, so law does not equal morality or ethics. So in particular, there could be things that are illegal and that are moral. An easier one to think of is there are things that could be immoral but be legal. And so if you're a standard libertarian, the obvious example here would be drug prohibition. So we make this kind of argument all the time. That if you're a standard libertarian, you say, hey, I think drugs should be legalized. Or if you really want to be snarky, you say the currently illicit drugs should be legalized, because obviously there's plenty of drugs right now that are perfectly legal. So it's a bit of a misnomer to talk on the war, to talk of the war on drugs. It's the war on some drugs. And when people come back and say, oh my gosh, so you think it's fine that little kids are taking heroin when they're 8 years old? I mean, that's, if you've been in these debates, you realize that's a crazy objection. That's the most ridiculous objection imaginable. And you say, no, you can think something is immoral, but also think it would be improper to have it be illegal. So, big clap of thunder over here. So if that's hard for some people to process, you know, if you're talking to somebody who's really for drug prohibition, they might not see that. So you could switch to something even easier and say, okay, what about marital infidelity? Just about everybody thinks it's wrong to cheat on your wife, but yet not many people think it should actually be illegal, right? So they don't think you should be, the police should come and put you in jail, or that the government should fine you if you're unfaithful to your spouse. But yet most people would say that's a very bad thing to do. You committed a serious offense in terms of ethics or morality, or if you're religious, you could say that was a bad sin, but yet it wasn't a crime. All right. Also notice, too, that in terms of our own snap judgments, some things could be very, very immoral and yet be legal, while other things might be illegal but not be all that immoral. So, for example, if a guy has a running affair with someone, with some young girl, and gets her pregnant and then just abandons her, and then goes off back to his wife or something and doesn't say a thing to her wife, and then the girl comes forward and says, oh, he's the father, and I've never seen this girl before, and it gets her fired from the job and stuff because he's just embarrassed by the situation and just totally ruins her life and lies about it to everybody. It's possible that, assuming he never went to a court and testified under oath or anything, it's possible he didn't break any laws in what he just did. But yet you would think that guy is a scoundrel. He committed all sorts of immoral acts there in that little scenario I described. Whereas some 12-year-old kid is in the store and he really wants a candy bar and he doesn't have quite enough money and he just takes it and he walks out of the store and he gets away with it. Well, he just committed a crime. That's theft. But I think most people would say in the grand scheme of things, what that kid did pales in comparison to what that hypothetical guy did that I just talked about, right? So just, again, see this distinction. You don't have to be some libertarian theorist. You can get anybody to see this. Another example would be going up to your grandma and saying you think she's ugly, and, oh, my gosh, you're wearing that dress? That's disgusting. I can't believe it. You're terrible. That's a pretty awful thing to say to your grandma, especially if you're still pretty young. But yet not too many people in the Western culture are going to say that should actually be a crime to talk of that to your grandma. All right, so I think you guys see the point. But it's when I make these big examples here, the point seems obvious, but you'd be surprised. You start arguing this stuff even with other libertarians and anarcho-capitalists, even sometimes things really quickly devolve, and some people think that the law needs to cover every possible social behavior imaginable. In any sanction that anybody ever gives, they want to say is part of a private legal system, and I think that's wrong. Okay, so let me just emphasize that point again. Even if we're all agreed now, if we're all among friends and we're all anarcho-capitalists and we're just talking about the nature of this society, even here, it's still the case that there will be things that would be immoral but not illegal. Okay, so it's not the case that an anarcho-capitalist is striving for a society in which the law code recognizes as bad everything that personal anarchist thinks, and with his own moral code, is illegitimate. Okay, there's a distinction between morality and justice, or morality in the legal system, even if you're living in a society that you think is the appropriate one. So this distinction is not merely confined to the state. It's not simply that, oh, right now the state's punishing things that I think should be legal. It's also the fact that in an anarcho-capitalist world, the sorts of things that private judges and private enforcement agencies would be acting on would be just a small subset of other things that you might want to punish in other ways, right? So you might have a boycott of a restaurant because it's doing something that you think is wrong or immoral, and it doesn't mean that, oh, if we were living in a proper society, what they're doing would be illegal, and that it wouldn't just be my abstention from patronizing them, but it would also be the actual enforcement agencies would roll up with guys with guns and would deal with that. That doesn't need to be the case. Okay, another thing that I think is important to stress is that the legal system is theoretically distinct from law enforcement. And what that means in practice, if we're talking about an anarcho-capitalist world, is that different firms would provide legal rulings versus enforcement. Okay, and the reason I'm stressing this is that even in standard Austrian libertarian treatments of this, I think a lot of times the two issues get conflated. So I think, like in Murray Rothbard's standard treatment of this stuff, he makes it sound like there's going to be different firms, all right, competing with each other, but that what each firm does is have its own internal rulings and its own internal enforcement. So that you've got the Acme Insurance Company over here with its own internal judges who look at a particular dispute and say, yeah, we think that this person's in the right. And then they also have the employees who also work for Acme that happen to have a bunch of guns or tanks or whatever. And then over here, there's the Prudential Insurance Agency, and it has its own internal judges who then look at a dispute and say, no, we think our client's in the right. And then they have their own guys with guns. And then if there's a thing when the two forces oppose each other, well, then Rothbard says, don't worry, they're not going to duke it out in the streets. They'll submit to some third agency with its judges and guns and so forth. So what I'm trying to get you to see is, both in theory and in practice, I happen to think these will be distinct functions. I think you will have one firm that does nothing except render legal opinions. It will make rulings in certain cases, and we'll talk in a few minutes about how that would work. And then there would be other firms that all they did was enforce what the community had decided the law is. So we'll probably come back to this point later on, but I want to stress up front that these are different things. So in practice, the state, by being a monopoly provider of the majority of these types of services, does both, but I'm saying I think that's an artifact of the state wanting to be in control. That the state wants to be able to make the laws, and it also wants to be able to enforce them, because if it had only one of those things, it would be pretty vulnerable, right? So if the state said, okay, we don't determine, it's not state employees who ultimately determine what the laws are, but then we reserve the right to have all the guys with guns enforcing them, well, then it really wouldn't be in charge if people in the private sector could say what the rules were. People in the private sector could determine who the criminals were and who the innocent citizens were, then the state's monopoly on the use of force would be a little bit pointless, but wouldn't have much teeth if they could only point guns at people that people in the private sector said were it was acceptable to point guns at. That's, on the other hand, if the state said, no, we are the ultimate arbiter of who the criminals are and who should go to jail for 30 years, but then the state actually, no state employees actually had guns and they had to rely on people in the private sector enforcing those edicts, then again, the state would be fairly vulnerable because they would realize if we ever get too out of line and the people in the private sector start thinking we're issuing crazy verdicts, they might just turn on us. And so that's why we want to have our direct employees with the ones with the guns. So notice what I'm already hitting up against a common view of why it seems natural for there to be a single group that has all the guns or the vast majority of the firepower, the ability to crush any dissenter. I mean, that's really what the state needs. It's not that it has to have every last gun in society, obviously, but what the state wants is that there is no question if anybody opposes it, the state will win and the opposer will lose. That's really what the state needs. And that it is the ultimate arbiter when it comes to determining who is a lawbreaker and who is not, that the state cannot have other people making those decisions, that it needs to reserve the right to be the final arbiter. And so because we're so used to thinking like that, because we've grown up in a world dominated by states, it's hard to even imagine how could those functions be distinct. Because for the reasons I just said, wouldn't a firm that had a bunch of guys with guns and flak jackets and those shields, those see-through shields that police use when they're putting down riots, wouldn't they want to also have the ability to issue the rules? And yeah, they might want to, but I'm saying they wouldn't be able to in a free society. And so that's the kind of thing that we're going to try to hit in tonight's lecture is, can we even, let's not worry about the objections to it, but first of all, is it even internally coherent to imagine a society where there is no single group that lays out the legal code and that enforces it? Because for a lot of people, they can't even get past step one. To them, it seems like, well, of course there has to be one group that does all that. Even Ayn Rand thought that. As much of a proponent of free markets as she was, she just could not imagine how could it possibly work. It didn't even seem rational to her. It wasn't merely that it was impractical. She thought it didn't really even make sense to speak of competing providers of legal rulings and enforcement services. Okay, so that's what we're trying to hit tonight. And then, like I said, once I give you the framework, then next week we'll start dealing with objections to that framework. Okay, another important thing is that law is not the same thing as legislation. And so Hayek was the person that I saw who made this point. And notice that Hayek wasn't an anarchist. Okay? So, but nonetheless, as a student of history, Hayek made this brilliant point, and it's, and a lot of us, I think, we use the terms as well, and I probably have already done it in this class tonight, that I have casually talked about the government establishing laws, and what Hayek's point is that we need to be very careful that historically this notion that human beings could make law, that's actually fairly new. That, and I'm not enough of a historian to be able to tell you guys when this change gradually seeped in. But the point is, for many centuries in recorded history, the people who were in charge, the rulers, it didn't even occur to them that they could just make up the rules governing society. that there were definitely laws in the sense of rules that people thought were really important to the maintenance of the social order, and that if they caught anyone violating those rules, they would get punished by the group. And that, so you can imagine, it's something, you know, going way back before there were governments in our formal sense even, and as people emerged from the jungles and started forming, went from hunter-gatherers to more agricultural-based communities and so on, I mean, there was a mutually reinforcing process there where they started getting more regularized customs. You can see from an evolutionary perspective, like prohibitions on cannibalism. It's not that some elder had to just think through and say, oh, wait a minute, it's not right to eat people, let's stop doing that. That you can see from an evolutionary perspective why taboos on cannibalism and incest, you probably should have taboos on incense too because it smells so weird, would be evolutionarily selected for, right? And so if there were communities way back when and during early humanity, the emergence of Homo sapiens and what have you, that the groups that for whatever reason had this taboo against incest, they would prosper relative to the ones that didn't have that taboo or the ones that just thought cannibalism was disgusting and that if they caught somebody eating his neighbor's arm would exile a guy from the community, and so everyone learned, oh, you're not supposed to eat people. Those sorts of societies would prosper more, and the people where, for whatever reason, whether it was because they had religious rituals or they were afraid of the shame in punishing them or whatever the reason was, if they started to respect property rights in some rudimentary fashion, they would prosper. And so Hayek just gives this account where he's saying, over time, there's no such thing as a community that doesn't have any kind of rules at all. They would die out very quickly. So any prosperous society where the population grows and now we have an actual society to speak of, clearly those people obey all sorts of rules, whether they've actually been formally codified or whether they're just all tacitly known. Like maybe no one ever just stopped and thought about it and said, you know, when someone invites you to dinner, you probably shouldn't just gouge his eyes out. Like maybe that never even occurred to anybody, but you just kind of naturally know you're not supposed to do that. And that if somebody did do that, he would either just get killed by the community or they'd kick him out or something like that. But it would be clear to everybody that is unacceptable behavior socially. All right. So Hayek's point was there were all sorts of rules like this that developed over time, and with a combination of just trial and error and just spontaneous evolution in a customary sense, and then also just rational recognition of why they might be good things to do. But he was saying the idea that the rulers had the authority to change the laws, he said that was a relatively new innovation in human history, that it wouldn't even have occurred even to some of the most despotic rulers in previous times, that they had the authority to do that. And so the terms Hayek was using, he was contrasting law with legislation. So clearly, well, even I see people talking about like divine right absolutism and things like that, but even there, and again, I'm not a historian, so I don't want to go on this too much because I'll probably end up saying something false. But even there, I think we have a very convenient modern notion of what those silly divine right ruling kings thought. I mean, you could believe that you were appointed by God to be the king and yet not think you had the authority to tell people that they had to provide their neighbors with health care or something like that. You see what I'm saying? That you could think the legal code was what it was because God established it like that, and just, oh, guess what? The person who's got to enforce it is me. I'm the guy at the top of the pyramid here because God told me in a dream or because my bloodline runs this way and that's the way God ordained the world. So you could be that kind of a megalomaniac and think that you should be in charge of whole Earth and be God's representative on Earth, but yet not think you had the authority to change how much tenant farmers had to give to their baron, and that how much the dukes owed you in tribute. You might just think, well, no, that's just the way it's always been. Who in the world could possibly think I could change that number, right? Again, I'm making up specific examples. I don't know in practice, but I think that the general theme there that I'm telling is correct, that it was not until really the rise of democracy in the modern sense where people really started to think, and especially the rise of secular humanism and the Enlightenment and those sorts of ideas, where people more and more started to think the only reason we have these rules guiding social interaction is because they help us. And if we look at a particular social custom or thing that used to be considered the law and we don't see any benefit from it, well, out it goes, because we can do whatever we want. Man is the measure of all things. We live in a democratic society. The government does whatever we, the people, tell it to do, and there's no limits. You know, who could possibly, you know, we're all atheists now, or if we believe in God, he's this real distant, abstract thing that is not a being with whom we have to grapple, and we make our own decisions, right? So, again, I'm speaking in broad generalities, but you see how the trend of political philosophy and people's religious views and so on and their approach to the legal code evolved, and that's why Hayek was stressing this point, that it is a modern hubris to think that because 51% of us put these people in charge temporarily, they could just rewrite the laws governing society. So it's not merely the standard economist point that, hey, there's economic law that you can't change, and if you, as a government official, try to institute some rule that's in violation of economic law, it's going to blow up in your face. I mean, every economist would talk like that, but Hyde was pushing it deeper and saying the very notion that you have the authority to do that is a fairly new concept. And by new, I don't mean since 1952. I mean like since the Enlightenment, or maybe the a few centuries prior. But the point is, even rulers who were in charge of what we would call the government and law enforcement, historically, they didn't necessarily think that meant they were in charge of picking the laws. They kind of just thought the laws were what they were. Okay, so I've talked a lot about what law is not. What do I think law is? And again, I'm not going to give a great quote here, a great definition for you, because I'm still not sure myself. But fortunately, I'm not a legal theorist. I'm here as an economist, and I'm going to show you the economic forces that will be at work guiding the evolution of a purely private society that does not have a monopoly agency arrogating to itself the right to provide legal and military services. Okay, so in case that seems weird to you, an analogy I can use is with education, or let's say schooling. As an economist, I'm very comfortable in saying I don't think the government should have a monopoly on schooling. I think the government should get rid of mandatory attendance laws. The government shouldn't spend any tax dollars funding so-called public schools. Throw it all open to the private sector. Now, what if some education philosophy major comes up to me, you know, someone who has a degree in education comes up to me and he's, okay, Bob, what's your definition then of education, or what's your definition of schooling, and what sort of institutions, like what sort of firms would you call schools, and what would be businesses that aren't schools, and what's the dividing line, and give me a hard and fast rule. And I'm not sure, like, you could say, oh, that's a daycare center, but what if they teach the kids how to read, or what if they put on educational videos, like, you know, how some of the kids' videos are kind of educational? Is that really a school, or is it a daycare center? You see, so you can get all these fuzzy areas, but my point is, as a free market economist, I don't even need to go down that path. I can say, whatever your definition of schooling is, I can give you all these reasons for why the provision of schooling services is better handled by competing firms on a market, or not even necessarily firms, but the individual parents just homeschooling their own kids, versus a very monopolized or nearly monopolized state sector providing it. Okay, so you see how that analogy works there, and I don't need to read a bunch of books on the philosophy of education and schooling per se. Well, it's the same thing here. I mean, I have to have a general familiarity with what the law is if we're going to talk about this, but the point is, strictly speaking, I don't want to get into an argument with you guys about the definition because we'll probably disagree. But the point is that we don't need to have that. I can give you all sorts of reasons that whatever you think of as the legal code or what it means for something to be part of the law, that that will be better approximated in a what I call a free society than in a statist society. Okay, but let me just give you a hint. I think a lot of what we're going to have to talk about is going to be bound up with property rights, so that as a general rule, breaking the law is the same thing. So breaking the law is the same thing as violating property rights. So that really when I'm talking about how would the legal code be defined or codified in a free society without a state providing all this stuff, for me that's somewhat equivalent to saying how would property rights be defined or codified and promulgated in a free society. So notice, again, that's not the same thing as saying who's going to enforce them. Saying first, the issue is, the logically speaking, the first thing to figure out is how would we even define property rights? How would we even know, hey, there's a house over there, does somebody own it or does some group of people own it? And what does it mean to say they own the house? Can they prevent an airplane from flying over it at 10,000 feet? Can they prevent their neighbors from down the street from having a cookout because maybe the smell of the hot dog will go in an open window of the house? So it's not enough just to say, oh, Jim Smith owns that house. You have to be much more specific and say what bundle of privileges or rights or whatever terminology you want to use does Jim Smith possess because we're saying he's the owner of that house. So presumably he can tell people to get off his property. But what does that mean? Does he, can he say, get off, and if the person says, what, I didn't hear you, can Jim shoot him in the head and say, hey, I told him to get off, and he didn't do it? I think most people would say, nah, that doesn't sound right to me. Okay, so it's not simply, hey, who owns the house. It's really much more complicated than that. And these are all kinds of really tough questions. And so the issue is, how would we in a free society go about resolving those kinds of issues? And again, notice this is a completely distinct question from saying, given that we all have this framework that we agree upon, and everybody, you know, there's no dispute among honest, civilized people about, oh yeah, Jim Smith owns that house. And no. If he tells someone to get off and the guy says what, Jim's supposed to repeat the command. If the guy's really being a jerk, you know, Jim's allowed to use, but if he's not posing a threat, then Jim can take certain measures to kick the guy off. If the guy pulls a gun, Jim can shoot him in cold blood. I mean, that's fine because he's self-defense. Even if we all agree on all those different things, then it's a separate question to say, okay, suppose Jim needs help. He's completely within his legal rights to use force to eject the guy from his lawn, but now Jim picks up the phone and wants to call someone to help him exercise those property rights. Take it from there, Mr. Free Market Economist. What happens? Is there one firm that has a monopoly? Are there competing firms? You see what I'm saying? So notice, though, that those are distinct things altogether to figure out what does Jim have the right to do, or what are the property rights in this situation versus suppose they are actively being violated or Jim is worried that they might be violated at any moment, what steps can he do or what steps can he take? Okay, public versus private law. Let me just give you some observations on that. Okay, why monopoly? So what I mean here is the standard objections to monopoly that would apply in any other field apply here too. All right, so just think about obvious ones, police brutality. And so maybe we can't ultimately convince people with the various discussions and readings I've assigned you guys. Maybe the critic is going to say, when all is said and done, come on, you guys are nuts. You got to have a government. You got to have a monopoly police force. You got to have the military that the government pays for through taxation. You guys are a bunch of dreamers. Okay. Still, I think it's unequivocally true that a lot of what we associate with unfortunate things that the police and military do are due to the fact that they're monopolies. They don't face competition. That if you're a customer of these groups, you can't withhold your payment. So things like police brutality, judicial corruption, and police corruption, rampant overspending, these types of things. So say what you will about the pros and cons of having a monopoly police force. When the police gets caught on the 6 o'clock news just beating the hell out of somebody that clearly is subdued and isn't a threat to anybody at that moment, and the police are just kicking the guy and it's caught on somebody's smartphone, clearly the police don't get in as much trouble as any other group in society would. And even all but the most knee-jerk defenders of the police would agree in many of these cases that happen in the United States all the time, and I'm sure they happen in other countries too, where a police officer gets caught doing something clearly out of line, clearly an excessive use of force, and yet the worst thing that often happens is maybe they get relieved of their duties and they take their pension and they go do something else. But very rarely does a police officer actually end up in jail the way anybody else would in any other occupation for doing the exact same thing. All right, so there's this presumption that the police are this higher form of life and they have special privileges to engage in violence that the rest of us don't have, even if it turns out the person, the victim of their violence is an innocent person, right? So the police get a tip, there's a drug house, and they get the address wrong or the tip was bad, they break in the door, they come in, some guy wakes up in the middle of the night, he's got guys running his house, he doesn't even know what's going on, he pulls a gun out of his drawer and they shoot him. And then, oops, the guy's not a drug dealer. He's a totally innocent guy. He's a pastor at a local church. Do the police get in trouble? No. I mean, the government might pay money to his widow or to his next of kin, but it's not like those officers are going to get fired, and they certainly aren't going to go to jail the way you would if you thought somebody stole your TV and you went down the street and broke into the guy's house and shot him to death and then said, oh, actually, somebody else who stole the TV. But this guy looks like the guy that I saw, so honest mistake, won't happen again. You'd go to jail for that. That wouldn't be a good defense. Okay, so I'm saying those sorts of things clearly happen because the police had the monopoly and the officers are not going to testify against one of their own because they realize that could come back on them. And even if you did have a few honest cops who feel bad about that and realize, well, geez, I'm never going to just, you know, pull somebody over and then start beating them to a pulp. So why wouldn't I speak up? Well, they don't because they would, the other officers would get mad at them. Right? So that's the way this is enforced with the police culture is you never rat on a fellow police officer. And the same thing is even more so in the military. I was listening to, I forget the exact, it was the case where there was some unit that like went into a village and just shot up a bunch of Iraqis or Afghans? I think it was in Iraq. Just shot them up and buried them. Just got rid of the bodies because they were, you know, they were doing some retribution. Like there had been attack suicide bombers or something hitting that unit in the area, and they said to the town, cut this out, tell us who these fighters are, or else we're going to punish you. And then they decided to take matters in their own hands. And so somebody in that thing just felt really awful about it and was like talking to his dad, who had been in the Army or the Marines, and was saying, you know, Dad, at what point do you actually speak up and say something? And the dad said something like, it would have to be absolutely reprehensible what they were doing. I mean, it was a pretty high bar his dad gave him for saying, son, only under these circumstances would you ever step forward and report that your comrades are doing things that are out of line, right? Outside of the police and the military and any other occupation, that attitude doesn't exist. It's not like when I was a college professor, somebody, you know, if I said to my boss, you know, I'm a little bit worried that maybe one of the professors here always cheats, or he's sleeping with students. At what point would I say something to the administration, or would I go to the media? You wouldn't expect a person to say, oh, it would have to be absolutely reprehensible before you ever turned in one of your economist colleagues. He wouldn't talk like that. He would probably say, who are you talking about? What, he's doing what? And not because we're all better people, but institutionally, because we realize we could get in big trouble if it's turned out that one of our colleagues in our department sleeping with students or something, or is a drug dealer on the side, we might lose our funding. Okay, so you see how it's not just that the police and the military are a bunch of evil people compared to everybody else, it's that the institutional framework is different. They're not going to get in trouble for that kind of stuff, and so it makes sense for them not to step forward and report it, because why would you do that? You're just going to have the press get mad at you for a couple weeks. That's silly. All right. Same thing like with judicial corruption. I mean, it is well established. It's not some conspiracy theory that when it comes to organized crime and black markets, that they routinely pay off large sums of money to judges and police, and more specifically, the drug enforcement components of the judicial system. All right, so that's, we'll talk a little bit more about this next week, and that was the reading I assigned to you guys. You may be curious, why did I do that? But from Lessons from the Young Economist, so my introductory textbook, I assigned the lesson for this course to you guys on drug prohibition, because that's a really crucial thing for you to understand well. You need to understand the economics of that and to understand why is it that when there is a prohibition on what would otherwise be a voluntary market, where there might be lots of immorality going on, but that it's a genuine market of exchanging goods and services that both parties benefit from, at least in their own heads, why, if you try to prohibit that and make it illegal, it causes all sorts of things like violence, the infusion of organized crime, and then massive payoffs to police and DEA officers and so on. Okay, so make sure that's an important thing to read for those of you who might have thought, oh, come on, I don't need to read something from a little kiddie textbook. I want to read the hardcore stuff. That chapter, actually, I get into some stuff you may never have heard before that's relevant to a class on anarchy. Okay, and then the last thing was, but just to continue that point, so in any other context, if there were competition involved and you had different firms providing something, if one firm got caught with its employees getting paid to do things corruptly, you know, to not do their job on the merits, but to just throw it to the group that was getting paid or that was paying them under the table, that would be a mark against it. And that would hurt, and so you'd have incentives in place to minimize that sort of thing. But you don't see any of that when it comes to judicial enforcement in our society. And I would say, again, because there's a monopoly. And then the rampant overspending, just things like the military's budget on certain things. We've heard about these mythical $600 toilet seats that the Pentagon had. And what's funny there is, I actually had someone get mad at me about that. So in case you don't know, back in the 1980s, there was this audit of the Department of Defense and it came out that these certain budget summaries, it worked out that when they looked at how much total had been spent and how many toilet seats had been produced or purchased, it was like $600 for each one. And so that just now has entered the libertarian handbook in terms of when you're arguing with people about government spending. You say, oh yeah, military spends $600 toilet seats. I put that in one of my columns one time and some guy got mad at me. Apparently there's some nuance there. It was like, it was a toilet seat that was supposed to be installed in a high altitude bomber or something, and they wanted it so that if the plane flipped upside down, stuff wouldn't come out, right? So that he was pointing out that, and there were a lot of upfront fixed costs to developing it, and then he said, and they didn't order very many, so yeah, a huge upfront development cost divided by the number of seats worked out to 600 a seat. So anyway, take that for what it's worth. But the point is, clearly, the Department of Defense spends way more on acquiring military hardware than a private firm would. And the reason is that there's a monopoly here, and they're using it to funnel money to their buddies as opposed to them operating on a strict budget and being very cost conscious the way the competing firms would be. So again, here, it's not that this observation seals the deal and we can just move on with our lives because I just made the case for anarchy, but the point is, all of the things, all of the reasons that we would be worried about having a monopoly in any other area, like, well, gee, why don't we have a monopoly in the production of apples, not meaning computers, but actual, the fruit, we'd say, well, because then the apple farmer who owns everything would cut back production and prices would be higher, so consumers would pay more for a bushel of that or a pound of apples than they would if there were competition, and the owner would have much less incentive to make sure that the apples look nice, and that if customers complained about something, he wouldn't care as much because if you want apples at all, you got to come to me. What do I care? Whereas introduced competition, all of a sudden, everything's different. Okay, so the standard arguments against monopoly apply here as much as they apply anywhere else. And so the question then is simply, are there factors that trump that objection that are special to judicial services and military defense? Okay, here, this next slide, Rofford's definition of the state separates law and enforcement. Here, let me put a big question mark next to this. Because what happened is I had made this slide the last time I taught this course, and I had noticed one in his discussion in one area, and so I was like, oh yeah, see, Rofford agrees with me. But then today, in getting ready for tonight's lecture, I was reading other things Rofford had written that seemed to contradict this point I was going to make to you. That's why I'm putting this question mark. This is a debatable point. But anyway, what I was going for here is to say that in some places, Rothbard claims that the state engages in taxation, that that's where it gets its revenue from, and that it has a monopoly on, let me just say, it's the ultimate arbiter of proper use of force. Okay, so I've seen certain places where that's where it looks like Rofford is defining this, is how he defines the state. But then, like I say, today in getting ready for this lecture, I noticed other places where this second component, he does basically say they have a monopoly on law and its enforcement. Okay, so obviously if he's saying that the state is the institution that derives its income from taxation and has a monopoly on law and its enforcement, that's kind of lumping the two things together. But if he's saying this weaker thing, that I think I have seen in some of his writings, where he's saying really what the state is the institution that claims to be the ultimate arbiter of the legitimate use of force. Then there it's separating it out, and you can see this. And I think it's true in practice that, for example, there's all kinds of private groups that use force in service to the state. Okay, so the state can contract out prison services, right? So private companies can run prisons, and they can lock people up, and they can have guards that can beat the heck out of you if you get out of line, and can even kill you. And the state's okay with that and oversees it, because the state will come in and say, yep, that's legal, you can do that. All right, so it's not the state enforcing the rules per se, it's subcontracted out. Or over in Iraq and so forth, what do they do when they would sign agreements saying, oh, we're going to reduce U.S. troop presence over in Baghdad? Well, yeah, they reduced the number of official Marines and Army units there, and then the government with tax dollars just hired a heck of a bunch of private security contractors. So there, too, I wouldn't say that that was anarchy or a move towards anarchy. It's still the state, and instead of hiring people directly, it hires nominally private firms that basically exist in order to get government contracts. Okay. Also, not just with private prisons, but domestically, there are all sorts of private security forces that have the limits of what they're allowed to do circumscribed by the government. And so the state will say, if you're guarding a bank or something and somebody comes in with a ski mask on his head and a sawed-off shotgun, you can shoot him, and we're not going to throw you in jail. So in a sense there, the state is allowing that person to use force because the state is saying we're defining when it's appropriate, when it's not. So I think we can all agree that that's really what the state does. It's not that the state literally has a monopoly on the use of force. It's that the state says it is the ultimate arbiter. If there's ever any dispute about whether a particular use of force was justified. But it also is true in practice that the state has the overwhelming command of the use of force and will win in any standard dispute. So why did I bring that up last time? Because I wanted to make clear, again, this distinction that really I want us to stop thinking about the government as that entity that has a bunch of guns and enforces rules. I want to separate that out and say, yeah, the government in practice does a lot of that, a lot of rule enforcement with guns, but the thing that really makes the state is it's saying we are the entity that determines what property rights are and when you're a criminal and when you're not. And so we're then trying to figure out, could the things that the state does be possibly allocated by the private sector or provided by the private sector? I think we don't need to look and say, well, what's the analog of the state? Instead, say, no, there's two different services there. One is determining the legal code, and the other one is enforcing those decisions. Okay, so the possibility of private law. So I've talked a lot about this. Again, just to reiterate here in this lecture, I'm just trying to warm you up and show you how could this even make sense coherently as a possibility. And then next week, we'll try to argue more along the lines of, now that we've shown you the way it might work at all, let's compare it. Let's say this system now in practice, put it in a wind tunnel, so to speak, versus what the state does, and then try to see which one's better. So tonight, we're not trying to show it's better than the state so much as we're trying to show it's possible that this could actually exist. All right, so I like to use some analogies here, and part of what we're going to be getting at is this idea of, is law in the sense that we mean the term? So after all those things we went through about law versus legislation, and we don't just mean things that are bad, because we can describe an act as immoral but not think it should be illegal, that sort of stuff. So what we have in mind by what is the law, or what's the legal code, and we've seen that it overlaps a lot with, perhaps entirely with, our notion of what are the definition of property rights in a certain area. Is that body of information something that we just create, or is it something that we discover? And just so you know, historically, and this goes back to Hayek's point about law versus legislation, judges, like, so people who, jurists, which is like a fancy name for a judge that writes legal opinions, and other commentators on the law, when they would write volumes on this stuff and discuss various legal cases and so on, the further back you go, the more it became clear that they thought they were discovering and discovering and applying legal principles that were outside of them. And so the analogy there would be like with a mathematician, or even more obviously with a natural scientist. And so a physicist doesn't think he's inventing the laws of physics. He thinks he's discovering them. He thinks those laws exist independently of him, and his job is just to figure out what are these laws that are embedded in nature or in the mind of God, depending on your religious viewpoint. So there's that analogy. If that seems a little, but then you say, well, wait a minute, though, but there is a sense in which the law is more of a human institution. It's not completely independent of human beings, and especially since the law seems to evolve over time, whereas natural laws don't. That by their very nature, a natural law is something that's set in stone. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a law. You try to come up with some broader principle that encompasses the thing that right now you're viewing as a law of nature that changed. You try to come up with something that is invariant to time that explains everything. That's what you'd be striving for if you were a physicist. Okay, so I think maybe a better analogy then is with spoken languages. Okay, so just think through that. Because again, here there's no danger. We don't need to worry. There's nothing at stake here. And that's what I think, and that's why I like talking about this stuff first and warm people up, is that a lot of their knee-jerk reactions to when someone comes along and starts talking about could we have a privately provided legal framework, is they start worrying about things that are near and dear to them that would be jeopardized by such a system. And so they come up with all these objections. They're actually silly, but you realize it's because they're not really worried about those objections. They're worried about something else that maybe they don't even realize. All right. So whereas with talking about the spoken language, it doesn't seem like that much is at stake. And so people can calm down and just think through calmly and rationally about this. All right. So there are, generally speaking, there is no single group that says we are the ultimate arbiters of the definitions of English words and the proper grammatical use of the English language, right? And whatever your native tongue is, you can make the same argument. So it is true, like in France, for example, I think there is some sort of official body that makes judgments about, you know, are we allowed to use this word that the Americans invented? Well, no, because it's a horrible, decadent American term, blah, blah, blah. But generally speaking, most people, most languages don't even have such a group. And even in France, I'm sure people don't take that too seriously. And they actually don't have all that much power anyway. Okay, but, so let's just speak about English, because again, that's where I'm more comfortable here. There is no group that says this is what the definition of these words mean. And you might say, well, what are you talking about? There are private firms that publish dictionaries. Isn't that exactly what you just said doesn't happen? The dictionary literally tells you this is the definition of this word, this is the definition of this word, And if there's a dispute, when people are arguing with each other about what does a word mean, like if you're playing Scrabble and somebody puts some weird-looking combination of letters down, I say, yep, that's a word. And the other people say, no, it's not. How do you resolve that dispute? You go to the Webster Dictionary or the Oxford English Dictionary, whatever, and that's how you settle the dispute. So, Murphy, you just lied to us when you said there's no group, but no, push that further. What Webster's does, or the people who publish the Oxford Dictionary, they don't literally invent definitions. They don't get to decide what words mean. Their job is to codify, right? And that's a very important verb here. They codify the definitions. And if you're talking about a grammar book, the rules of grammar. They do not invent them. So, that's a very important distinction to make. If somebody said, if people looked up in the dictionary and it said next to the letter, the entry for the word UP, moving towards the ground, that was how it was defined, that's what the word up means, moving towards the ground. It's not that all the English speakers would all of a sudden say, oh, wow, I guess the definition changed. And now, from now on, when we want to talk about something going down, we're going to call that up. That's not what they would say. What they would say is, Webster screwed up. This is the wrong definition. That's not what the word means. You see what I'm saying? So no one group has the ability to define words. It is defined by the community. But yet, there is a sense in which these things are authoritative. So if there is a legitimate dispute, right now in practice, because we have this competitive system, and if Webster's consistently put wrong definitions in, they'd go out of business. And some other group would come along and offer a dictionary that codified the actual definitions. You see how that works? It sounds like a silly thing, but really, think through the logic of that. What would happen in practice on a free market if a dictionary company started publishing definitions that were just wrong? They would go out of business. So at any given time, the dictionaries that command market share are going to be the ones that most people say, yeah, this seems to be pretty reputable. And they would hire people that would actually write legitimate definitions, and that's so it would serve as a good reference book. So you can see there it's a very complex interaction that they can't just say whatever they want. So it's not that they have the ultimate authority to define words, but yet we need to have dictionaries. It's also not the flip side. It's not that they're so utterly powerless and without influence that we could just get by without having dictionaries at all. We need to have dictionaries. So that's, again, think through that. It's a very interesting thing. What good do dictionaries do if all they tell us is what we already know? And so you realize that's not what they do. Dictionaries provide most of us with information that we do not already have. But yet, there still is a sense in which the writers of the dictionaries are codifying what is generally known already in the community and practiced by them. Last thing, and I got to move on because we're running low on time here, notice definitions change over time. So a dictionary that was published when William Shakespeare was writing is going to look different from a dictionary published today. And so the legal code in a free market society would evolve over time. And all the things I just said about spoken languages, I think, would have analogs in a private legal code. That there would be different firms that would specialize in codifying the law as it was understood at that point. They wouldn't have arbitrary power to just invent laws, but at the same time, publishing these guides would be useful. And that private judges then would consult these reference materials when they had to apply the law in a given case, just like if you're an editor for a newspaper or you're running a think tank and you have authors that submit things, you have to give stuff to the editor to say, hey, make sure that this agrees with the Chicago manual style for how you write papers and that kind of stuff. All right, so there is a sense in which people apply these rules in specific instances, and the same thing would happen in a legal system where the law would be codified in very reputable places by jurists who were steeped in the tradition and who were acting as the analogs of the people that write dictionaries. And then the private judges would be the ones to apply the law in specific cases. Just like if you're the editor for a magazine, you apply the rules of grammar and spelling and blah, blah, blah in specific articles before you publish them in your magazine. Okay, so what do private judges do in a free market? And I can already see, by the way, I'm not going to have time for your questions tonight because we only got 9 minutes to go. So, but by all means, if you have questions, put them in the Q&A box, and I'll copy them and answer them in text form at the Moodle site. Okay, private judges, in my view, the way to think about what they do is they sell opinions. And notice this is an advance from my thinking in chaos theory. So I just want to be clear about that. I wrote chaos theory when I was in grad school, and I really at that time did not have a good understanding of where private law comes from in the first place. I was sort of taking it for granted that we already had this general framework of the legal system, and then it was just a matter of writing contracts that would clarify our interactions with each other, and then private judges would come along and rule on contracts. But I didn't really have an idea of, before you can get into the contracts, if you start from scratch, how do you start? And so that's what I was filling in with my essay that I also assigned for this week called The Possibility of Private Law. All right, so again, the progression of my own thinking on this, chaos theory came first, then I wrote The Possibility of Private Law a few years later because I had a better understanding of what it is that judges do. So if you're asking me from scratch, we all of a sudden have a bunch of individuals thrown together in society, and oh my gosh, there's no state providing laws, what do? Well, we already have intuitive notions of who owns what and what's proper and what's not. And I think that what a private judge does fundamentally is come along and offer an opinion when there's a dispute, and that everything else follows from that. But for me, that's just like you say, how could a doctor provide services in a free market? And so you say, well, what that would mean is if somebody's sick and has some money, he goes up to a guy and says, hey, if I give you this money, will you treat me? And then in the market, different doctors would step forward who have different levels of expertise in treating illness and so forth, and over time we'd expect a nice healthy market, blah, blah, blah. So the same thing, if you're saying from scratch, how would a legal system emerge? I think really what you'd say is we have a dispute, we can't settle it on our own, I think I'm in the right, the guy I'm arguing with thinks he's in the right, what do? Well, we could just take guns out and try to settle it that way, but I think in a civilized community, what you would do, you want the community to think you're in the right. So you don't want to just take matters in your own hands. Even if you're absolutely sure that guy down the street stole your TV, you would not just go down and take it back with force. If you really think it's an open and shut case and you have all kinds of proof, you go and get a third-party opinion. So you go to a reputable judge who has a history of giving what everyone seems to believe are impartial rulings, and you say, here's the evidence, I'd like to pay you for your time to look at this case and to learn all the facts, maybe interview a bunch of people who, of course, we think would give the information voluntarily. It's not that the judge could subpoena anybody because he's just this private guy who's going to give an opinion, so he couldn't compel you to come and tell him what you saw that Friday night, but he would ask you, can I ask you what you saw Friday night? And the person might say, yeah, I saw Johnny down the street running down with Bob's TV. And then the judge would take that into consideration and so on. I've got camera surveillance footage from my house showing Johnny in there walking out with the TV. Johnny now is watching a TV with his buddies, and he scratched the serial number off of it, so we can't determine whether it's actually my TV or not. All that kind of stuff. And then the judge would render an opinion, and he would say, based on the evidence I've seen, based on the law as codified in these various definitive journals or law books published by these companies that no reputable legal scholar has any problem with, I find in this case, it is my opinion that yes, Johnny down the street is guilty of stealing Bob's TV. That's my opinion, and that's what he paid me for, and I'm done. And then he moves on to the next case. So now there's this standing opinion in the eyes of the community that Johnny is a thief and took my TV, and maybe the judge also would say, and the penalty is Johnny should return the TV plus whatever 2 ounces of gold as punishment, as retribution for the crime. Or if the TV is no longer, if Bob looks at the TV and says, I don't want it, then Johnny has to provide the money that would replace the TV with one of comparable quality and then pay the 2 ounces of gold as further punishment. Okay, something like that. And now he's done. And if Johnny doesn't pay me, that's a separate issue, and now maybe I need to go seek the services of some firm that has a bunch of burly guys wearing flak jackets who are going to go and take my TV back with force. But that's going to be a totally separate company from the one that might keep the judge on retainer. Okay, so that's how I think the system would start from scratch, is that what the judges do is they render opinion, and having competition there works the same way having competition in the market for dictionaries works. And we don't worry about, oh my gosh, what if some rogue publishing company just starts publishing crazy definitions? Well, they would go out of business. And by the same token, if some rogue judicial firm starts publishing these guidebooks to the law that had all kinds of crazy definitions of things and said that the owners of this company have all the property rights in this region, well, people would just disregard that and they'd go out of business. The enforcement firms wouldn't enforce those rulings because they would quite clearly be erroneous. Just like if the dictionary said UP means moving towards the ground, nobody would change their behavior. All they would do is stop buying books published by that company because they would clearly be wrong. Okay, let's see here. This is the last slide for tonight, so let me just spend a few minutes on this. Incidentally, there's no way I can cover everything in these lectures, that you really, to get the full picture, should do these readings. I'm not going to assign that much material, and I was careful in the things that I did select, so you're going to get the most out of this course if you go and do the readings. And ideally, you want to do the readings beforehand, before a given lecture, but failing that, at least do them afterward, because I can only touch on certain points that are particularly subtle. I can't give you the whole theory from scratch because we just don't have enough time. Okay, so here I'm not going to go through the full-blown explanation of how insurance plays in with this. What I want to highlight for you is to make sure you understand there is a different emphasis in the literature on this point. Okay, so Rothbard and Hoppe view it more as sort of like, think of fire insurance is the good analogy for it, whereas I think of it more as medical malpractice insurance. So again, what I mean is when you're trying to think through the logic of our different approaches to how would insurance agencies in practice interact with the legal system. Because notice, I didn't talk about insurance companies yet at all. Whereas if you start reading Hoppe or Rothbard or Murphy on this area, pretty soon, boom, we're in a discussion of insurance companies. And so, again, and this is now more of my refined thinking, I realize that's kind of putting the cart in front of the horse. First, you got to just think through one-off payments. How did the private legal system get off the ground? And that's what I did in the previous slide. I think it's that when people have a dispute, they take it to a judge, and hopefully the two people can find a mutually agreeable judge, right? And that happens all the time. And a lot of people think, oh, that wouldn't work in practice, and we'll deal with that objection next week. But many times people will both agree on a judge because they both think they're in the right. And they say, no, the law's on my side, and you don't see it because you're an idiot. And if we went to an actual legal scholar, like Judge Napolitano, he would side with me. And the other guy says, no, he wouldn't, he'd side with me. And we say, okay, well, let's do it then. Put your money where your mouth is. Let's go pay his fee. We'll split it, and then he'll decide for us. And we both agree beforehand we will abide by his ruling. And I think that would be 99.9% of all the disputes would be settled in that way. And then next week we can worry about what happens when somebody says, well, apparently Judge Napolitano is an idiot too because I'm still right and I'm not paying you. And that's what we worry about. Okay, but right now let me just go 5 minutes over total, so I'll end very quickly. But I want to just, and then let you guys go, let me just clarify the different, and I'll talk more about this next week too. But right now, let me just make sure you realize there is a distinct approach. So for Rothbard and Hoppe, the way they view insurance companies is interacting in this environment is that you have insurance that says if any criminal comes and aggresses against you and causes you damage, we, the insurance company, will first of all indemnify you. So you're made whole right off the bat because some criminal took your property or injured your body, which is part of your property too. And then the insurance company now goes out and tries to recover the property or to somehow recoup the loss. And so that's sort of like you're just selling your right to go after the criminal to the insurance agency because they indemnify you. So the victims of crime are made whole right away by the insurance companies. And they, of course, pay the insurers premiums for that service. And now the insurance companies are the ones who may have private security forces, and then they go and hunt down the criminal. So some guy steals my TV, I don't know where it is, my insurance company, boom, right away sends me a check so I go get a new TV, so I don't care about it anymore. And now my insurance company hires detectives, and then when they find the guy with the TV who's three states away at this point, they send someone to go hunt him down and get the TV back. And then if the law says he has to do reparations of some kind, then he pays into the insurance company. Okay, so that's the way they're viewing it. I'm viewing it more, and these aren't mutually exclusive. I think there'd be a role for that, but the thing that I focused on in chaos theory that not all Rothbardians have endorsed, there's still some of them aren't sure whether this makes sense or not, but the angle I took and emphasized was to say you're going to an insurance agency to vouch for you. It's not that you're paying the insurance company to protect you in case some criminal hurts you. Rather, you're paying the insurance company so that you can say to the rest of the community, I'm safe to deal with. Because if there's ever a legal dispute and a judge rules that I've harmed you in some way, you don't need to worry about hunting me down or whether I have enough money to pay off what the judge says I owe you because of my crime. I have insurance, you can go check it with this reputable company that has tons of money, and they will pay you immediately. Okay, and again, the analogy here is with medical malpractice insurance. To be a surgeon, and the states require this, but I think even without state regulations in a free market, this would probably be fairly typical. Because if you screw up as a surgeon and kill somebody or disfigure somebody, and the courts decide it wasn't just that, hey, the person was close to death and it was a risky procedure. But no, if the courts decide, no, you really screwed up. You, as a surgeon, you did something very incompetent, and that's why this guy's leg got chopped off, or that's why this guy died on the table, so you owe him a bunch of money. Even though doctors have a high income, those judgments could be really devastating, and so they might not be able just to give some family a check for $500,000 because you screwed up one day and killed their kid on the operating table. So in order for you to practice surgery, you have to have medical malpractice insurance. So again, think of the logic of that. You as the doctor are not worried about someone coming in and stabbing you and you want to get a check to get made whole. you're telling the community, if you need surgery, come to me. Don't go to some other surgeon who doesn't have insurance, because you know if you come to me and I happen to screw up, because, hey, things happen, and you don't know who I am, I'm not going to screw up. I know I'm not going to, but you don't know that because you don't know me. You can at least be assured that I have a huge insurance company standing behind me. So that reassures you for two reasons. One, you know if, God forbid, something does happen and I kill your kid, you're at least going to get a huge check, whereas if you go to some fly-by-night surgeon, if he messes up the surgery, you might not have any legal recourse. I mean, the judge might say he owes you $500,000, but he won't. What if he doesn't have it? What are you going to do then? Second thing is, the very fact that I can get this huge insurance company to make such a pledge should reassure you, right? Because the insurance company's not stupid. They're not just going to blindly sign off and be on the hook for potentially millions of dollars unless they know I'm qualified, they've looked at my history, and they've charged me premiums accordingly. Okay, so that's, you know, when you think through the logic of why medical malpractice insurance works, and that I don't think it's simply because of state regulations, that there would be something like that even in a genuinely free market, then you can see why I just generalize that. And that's the kind of thing I think would happen just more generally, that I have some insurance company vouching for me, and why would I do that? Because now an employer is more likely to hire me. I'm more likely to have a landlord rent me an apartment, or a car agency will rent me a car, or a bank will let me open up a checking account and will give me a loan and that sort of thing if I have this standing commitment by a major insurance company saying, if he is convicted of a crime, we will pay up to such and such of the damages. Okay? All right. Well, let me stop there. I'm over time. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I will answer your questions before next week, and I'll send out an email blast giving you all instructions about if you're taking the class for credit, how to do the quizzes, and then on Saturday when those office hours will be. Okay. Thanks, everybody.